question I'd like to address to Professor Solomon. I really appreciate what you said about Ambassador Matlock talking about negotiations after the Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact dissolved, that his memory was that the promise was made that NATO would not expand one further inch. I heard an NPR program maybe a month or two ago about this issue, and the reporter was saying that either he or some scholars he had been in touch with had read the description of the talk that had gone on. You could find no such promise made that was in print, but that, according to what the reporter was saying, that the belief has been circulating that this promise was made, but he and the general scholars who have been looking at this had not found anything like that. Can you comment on that?
My understanding is that not too long ago, and I don't have the documentation, which I'm criminally irresponsible in that respect, but I think Matlock himself recently alluded to
this.
Yeah,
you are kind.
Yeah. But I mean, look, you know, one could argue about what's in the archives, what the documentation is, but it's pretty clear, I think, that the reunification of Germany was built upon certain kinds of politically cemented standards. You know, one was, of course, that you know, there were lots of problems, as one would know, in the German Democratic Republic, not the least of which was such a heavy-handed repressive security apparatus that it actually led to insecurity and to the collapse of the country. But it did have a very effective social system, you know, in terms of education, healthcare, housing, women's rights, particularly children's rights. And there was a determined effort to just wipe that out, wipe the slate clean, get rid of it, expunge it from the historical record. Don't let people know, especially West Germans, know about the extent of the social policy that did exist in the German Democratic Republic. So yeah, so reunification is almost like, from the standpoint of the Federal Republic at that time under Helmut Kohl, was a cleansing operation, you know, which was based in very, very large measure upon not just accommodation with the United States and with NATO, but almost like direction from the United States and NATO. So, you know, whether one could find the exact quote or not, I think one looks at the broader historical record of how Germany has evolved, you know, since 1989, 1990. I mean, it's pretty clear, you know, that one, Germany is solidly, irrevocably, from one standpoint, locked into NATO. And secondly, NATO, of course, has expanded well beyond Germany. So, yeah, I mean, those are facts that are incontrovertible. So, you know, what Matlock claims, you know, I tend to think there's a, you know, sometimes you go by instinct, and my instinct is somehow or other, having a little sense of what Ambassador Matlock was about and about what policy was about, it has a certain kind of ring of authenticity, this not one inch quotation.
Yeah, I'll quickly comment something that I heard on that same point was that apparently former President Gorbachev also indicated publicly that he had understood from Baker and believed that he had a commitment from Baker, who was Secretary of State under Reagan, that it would not be, that NATO would not extend beyond the Elbe or something like that. That was his and that was one of the reasons for his very early support of the agreement by President Putin to incorporate Crimea into Russian Federation. But I had a question that was more, I really learned a lot and really appreciate the discussion about the interstate relationships and some of it. There seems to be something going on, almost like what you were saying about Germany when it reunified, but at a different level. Right now, there seems to be behind the EU's push to incorporate Ukraine an effort to change the economy of Ukraine, even though it's, you know, basically another capitalist economy, struggling one, very weak one, to eliminate those things, what's left of any social programs that exist in the country. Sort of an austerity drive, similar to what was going on in other parts of Europe. It's part of this whole trend, I guess, in the Western world to attack these things. And I understand that that might also be another reason, besides the Russian language and the history and all of that, the part of the country that is calling for federation and opposing the Kiev regime is the one that's most unionized, that's most industrial, that has more of the sort of social program, pensions, all the things that those of us in this country with unions have seen come under attack here. And part of this deal with the EU, I understand, is to get rid of those pensions, to get rid of those unions, to sort of change the economy. So I wonder if you all could talk a little bit about that aspect.
Well, on the earlier question about the agreement to not to expand NATO, there was a former Soviet diplomat being interviewed on Russia Today the other day, and it was a very interesting analogy. He said it was a verbal agreement, and we didn't ask at the time for a written agreement, because that would be like girlfriends asking their girlfriends to sign written agreements not to seduce their boyfriends. You know, it was like impolite to ask for a written agreement. But then Putin the other day was saying that Boris Yeltsin had asked for written assurance that NATO would not expand. And sure enough, it does. In 1999, which is the last year that Putin is power, or in power before Yeltsin. I mean, Yeltsin is in power before Putin takes over in December.
Did you
want to
add anything?
I just one quote I had, and I didn't mention it. One of the observers looking at the whole development of economic policy in the midst of this crisis, the fact that Yanukovych was quite prepared in exchange for deals with Exxon, with Chevron and the others, was really prepared to abandon all vestiges of social policy that reflected in some measure, you know, in a kind of haunting way, the Soviet experience. And the forces that are operative now, in particularly in Donetsk and Lugansk, those areas which are heavily industrialized, there was one observer who said that one of their worries was that should Kiev solidify its control over the whole of Ukraine, the words that were used was that what happened to Greece would be generous in comparison to what could happen in Ukraine, because the economic underpinnings in that area, even though they're heavily industrialized, are very weakened right now by the world depression and all these other factors. And that's what's driving. There are a couple of people that there are these two guys, unfortunately, just guys, you know, who kind of represent the progressive kind of social democratic outlook, Kargolitsky and Buzgalin, and who've written extensively on. And both of them, you know, make the same point, really, that what is involved in eastern and southern Ukraine is, in unvarnished words, class struggle. It's a battle of the working class to hold on to the last vestiges of what it has in the face of an all-out assault, you know, with the IMF as the grinding force behind it all.
wanted to thank the speakers,
we need some women,
but also the sponsors.
I want to thank the
speakers and also the sponsors. I think this is a very important meeting. A lot of us think it's very important. In particular, I'm a member of a group that's affiliated both with Mass Peace Action and with UNAP, which is another important component of the peace movement, and with UNIP, I don't speak for my group, I'm a member. Metro West Peace Action, though, there's another, there's a leading member back there. What I am hoping for, just to summarize my wishes, my aspirations, would be for the peace movement to join together around this issue, which is more important maybe than any of us think, and to do what we did last August and September, and we stopped a war against Syria at that time. It was at the right time to intervene. The people didn't want a war. Congress didn't want a war. The British Parliament didn't want a war. And now this is happening again, except nobody's awake. Nobody's following this. The media is asleep. It strikes me how risky an adventure the United States is on right now. Are you sure you're right, Mark, that there are NATO exercises planned within the territory of Ukraine? I didn't see that in writing.
July 7th.
It's a British ship.
NATO exercises are planned for July.
So Congress should be exploding over this, and the media should be exploding. This is within a territory where there's a military contesting of power. To me, it's a little bit mind-boggling, and it takes me back to the mining of the harbors of North Vietnam and the blockade there. The campus I was on, it just exploded out of concern that there would be a war between the United States and Russia. And now we may be on the verge of such a thing if people in this country don't wake up and get together and get out in the streets and follow what the speakers are doing. I assume they will be on board with United Action.
Hey, Joe?
A couple of points. First of all, we're talking about U.S. ambassadors. I have a piece here from former Ambassador Burns from 2008 talking about Ukraine and Georgia's approaches to join NATO. And not only does Russia perceive encirclement, it also fears unpredictable, uncontrolled consequences which would seriously affect Russian security interests. Could lead to a major split involving violence at worst, civil war, and in that eventuality, Russia would have to decide whether to intervene, a decision Russia does not want to face. So I need to understand that at the high levels of the United States government, it's been a perception that the plane would fire. A couple of points. One is that I think we shouldn't underestimate the role of the EU in precipitating this crisis. To remember that it was Germany that precipitated the collapse of the Soviet of Yugoslavia with its recognition of Slovenia. My understanding is that the EU terms that were offered to Ukraine were essentially that they had to break their relations with Russia. And that's asking for that's asking for a crisis. Just a couple other points. Mike Clare, in writing about the tensions in the South China Sea and the EC, talks about the dynamics of a rising power and a declining power in tension. And while not saying what China's doing is right, he says, look, that's what great powers do. And so I think in looking at the situation, even though I would argue that in Russia's annexation of Crimea, they violated things called the Geneva Agreement, where they committed to recognize the territorial integrity of Ukraine. The reality is that this has been their warm war report since 1750. Mm-hmm. It's the foundation of so much of Russian power and influence. So I think just to bear that in mind. Two last points. One, the gentleman here, Mark Poore, I think was right in terms of what this crisis intimates. I think we're hoping that it's receding here. But that, as Dan Ellsberg said not long ago at Peace Action Event, right? We don't have to worry about the guys behind the nuclear missiles sleeping at the wheel. because now they've been on alert. And to understand that this is the danger that they're still in, and they need to respond. Last thing to say is that in terms of how we respond, there's a NATO summit in Wales in the very beginning of December. The Stop the War Coalition, CND, a lot of European organizations are organizing mass demonstrations. They would love to have as many people in the United States come as possible. They would love solidarity action. And then the last thing just to say is to appreciate there are bitter divisions within NATO. NATO is not unified. And it's from the press that I read is saying that there's a hope from the British banks and industry who want the Russian money to keep coming into Britain. Germany has been oriented toward integration with big profits from Russia. So there's huge divisions there. We need to kind of at least bear that in mind as we go forward. But I think we shouldn't underestimate the role of the EU and Germany in precipitating this crisis.
Just a brief point on that, Jeff. I had this in my notes, which I kind of skipped over, which I blame on my galloping, formerly creeping dementia. Actually, there was... The EU actually was pushing what they called, quote, active partnership, unquote, with Ukraine, which involved all these economic policies that we were talking about, which are very, very serious, as you say, in precipitating the crisis. That's quite true.
Along with that, I just wanted to add, can you talk about, I mean, a lot of these actions seem clearly, consciously obvious that it would provoke a crisis and provoke Russia. And what are the advantages? Why are some factions trying to provoke a new Cold War? What are they gaining from that?
How can they not follow their own nature? I think there have been three provocations and three responses, as I see it. The first provocation was in 1999, when without UN authorization, the U.S. Bombed Belgrade, the first time that a European capital had been bombed in the post-war period. And initially, Milosevic had been told you have to agree to transform your country into a NATO protectorate, basically. He had refused. The Russians were able to negotiate an agreement whereby Milosevic withdrew his forces from Kosovo, but did not agree to the initial NATO demands, or the Rambouillet demands. So it was a slight victory, a moral victory for the Serbs. But as the agreement was being implemented, Russian troops rushed to Pristina Airport, just as a sort of statement. And you might remember at the time Wesley Clark ordered a British general, a subordinate, to prevent the Russian advance, and he said, "Sir, I'm not going to provoke World War III for you." But so there, the Russians were there in advance of the NATO forces. It was a way of saying, we still matter. And then the second time was in 2008, when after the U.S. announced that it had recognized Kosovo, which had wrenched away from Serbian control in 1999, would recognize it as an independent country. And Russia said, you can't do that. That's illegal. It's a very bad precedent. We can do the same thing with Abkhazia and South Ossetia, which indeed they did. Some months later, when Mikhail Saakashvili, the Georgian president, who was planning to join NATO, had the audacity to attack South Ossetia and kill 12 Russian peacekeepers, causing the Russians to respond. And, of course, immediately there was outrage in this country, and John McCain saying, we're all Georgians now, but the U.S. was powerless to do anything, and now there is an independent South Ossetia and South Abkhazia. And this annexation of Crimea, I think, was another response to another provocation, and hopefully it will teach the provocateurs to stop it. Because I think that at this point it's unlikely that Ukraine ever enters NATO. I also think it's unlikely that Russia is going to invade the eastern part of the country. I think that Russia has what it wants. It's going to avoid Crimea ever being severed from it. And if that leads to a period of disorder in the Ukraine, Russia is as likely to profit from that as it would from directly invading and incurring universal opprobrium. So.
I have two questions or points. First, neither of you mentioned the Orange Revolution, so-called Orange Revolution in 2004. The U.S. takeover of Ukraine has been like a two-step process where in 2004, through the NED, they organized protests, and when Yanukovych was elected in 2004, they made Ukraine, cancel the election, and then... But Yanukovych was then later re-elected by the Ukrainian people who actually wanted him to be president. And my understanding is that the events in 2004 did succeed in severing the Ukrainian economy to a large part from the Russian economy, and that before that, Ukraine had a very high standard of living, and then afterwards, the economy in Ukraine has gone downhill since they're no longer tied with Russia, that their economy... the interests of the Ukrainian people are with being closer allied with Russia in economic terms. So I don't know if either of you have more comments about that, but my other question is, in response to something that Mark Solomon said, you seem to be saying that Obama and Putin were coming up with a deal about what to do about Yanukovych's waffling about which side, whether he was going to be with Europe or Russia, but that Victoria Nuland foiled that, and also the U.S. ships in the Black Sea like stopped that. But Obama, Victoria Nuland is like a person in Obama's cabinet. Obama controls the State Department, and he's also the commander in chief of the U.S. military. So I don't see like. What I see is that the U.S. propaganda machine, when it demonizes Russian actions, it always puts the blame on Putin personally, that it's Putin's personal ambition to take over Crimea and Ukraine and stuff. But then with regards to U.S. actions, like Obama is portrayed as not really wanting to do the bad things, but being pushed to do those things by the Republicans, and then that like leads to peace activists like being like pushed to support the Democrats to try to solve these problems when the Democrats are really just as into doing these imperialist things as the Republicans are. So.
Let me respond to the second part. I agree with you. Obama, the presidency bears responsibility for all this. We don't know with precision, with exactitude, exactly what happened from the morning of February 21st to the night of February 22nd. The fact that we do know that Obama and Putin were in direct communication, we do know that a meeting took place involving the United States and foreign ministers of France, Poland, and Germany. That an agreement had been reached regarding elections, and as I indicated before, elections in December, a broadened unity government, including substantial participation of various opposition elements, all that sort of thing had been agreed to. The very fact that it unraveled somehow, and now I've heard talk, I have never heard it really authenticated, that there were armed people in the parliament building when the vote took place to kick out Yanukovych, etc. The fact of the matter is, whatever happened, whatever brought about that change, you're right. I mean, Obama is responsible, whether he was undermined by these neocon elements in his own State Department. Well, you could give some little bit of weight to that, but that's not the substantive, substantial aspect. It's that the presidency bears the responsibility for the policy. I just heard slivers of Obama's speech today, which is really interesting, because he argues in his speech, which he's argued before, that this is not a return to the Cold War, You know, there's reflective of certain tensions and splits within ruling circles in this country. There are some elements who do represent do recognize the dangers involved in this situation. The losses that have already taken place in terms of the loss of Crimea to Ukraine. And as I try to very inaptly point out before, because the Crimea has been annexed, according to the law of the sea, the mineral deposits surrounding Crimea now fall into the hands of Russia. And the biggest loser in that particular situation is Ukraine, because they're losing the coastline that supposedly contains all these energy deposits that are very lucrative and productive. So these guys have screwed themselves with this coup d'etat, essentially. There's no question of that. And that probably causes certain strains. So Obama, on the one hand, is trying to say, well, we're not returning to the Cold War. But on the other hand, what I find absolutely fascinating is here you have the collapse of, supposed collapse of an ideology, the collapse of a system that presumably was supposed to try to spread its ideology around the world. You now have a capitalist Russia, a capitalist United States, but the specific dynamics, the power relationships and the ambitions, which comes back to the previous question about why these people do these things, it turns out that the fact that there was a Soviet Union and there's now no longer a Soviet Union is perhaps, strangely enough, less consequential in terms of the dynamics of economic and strategic and political competition than we realize. So, you know, Obama could say, well, this is not a return to the Cold War, but then he clicks off all the sanctions, you know, all the efforts to undermine the Russian position in the region, the role of the International Monetary Fund. He goes on and on, trying to justify, you know, for those attacking him on his right, the fact that he's supposedly engaging in a very forceful and effective kind of checkmating of Russia. So, basically, I agree with you. That's sort of.
Duncan.
Well, I think the Ukraine situation, the challenge that peace movement views at world of. Now, David over here made reference to the Syria situation last August and September. Now, I think he's right. The peace movement acted in a very united and increasingly effective way and helped stop the war. There are different reasons, but the peace movement played its role, helped stop the war. The situation in Ukraine, I don't think we're seeing this effective action like we did on Syria, and yet the potential for a major war is significant. Why is that? I think in one reason is that in Syria you had this very over obvious impending military attack and invasion. Everybody could see what was happening. We knew who was deciding, the Obama administration. We knew what to do. But in the Ukraine, you had this covert operation over years and $5 billion worth of funding, you know, attempts to overthrow the government, and then you have this movement, you have progressivism, might and swear, you have neo-fascists, it's very confusing, what's the politics about? And so I don't think the peace movement has frankly been, you know, as effective as it needs to be. And I think that I don't have the answers. I think this educational forum is a great first step. I think, you know, I like the petitions. But I'm not clear exactly what do we do to get this effective, united action that David refers to. It's not so clear to me. So I think we need some creative discussion, you know, moving forward.
I had a quick question. Two things. First of all, I heard that during Olympics, the underground U.S. government CIA was all over Ukraine. And I don't know if that's true or not, setting up this whole overthrow. The question I have today is Biden's son. Biden's son's come out, he's investigating Ukrainian gas all over Ukraine, and then some of his friends. And some other Americans are doing that. And what do you guys have to say about Biden's son connecting to Biden? I mean, George Bush's sons did this, he did it, Bush family, so shows that Democrats, Republicans, I can't even tell the difference half the time. So Biden's not suggesting help in Ukraine. What do you say about that?
It's not surprising. These guys have an enormous talent for smelling out possibilities and exploiting situations. That's why they to a very large measure, that's why they run for office, to have this kind of power and leverage. Interesting thing, by the way, regarding Biden, is that there was a whole, at a critical juncture, you know, after the coup, you had three specific visits, you know, with the United States signaling its alliance with the Yatsevich, you know, the new group that had taken over in Ukraine. One was a quick visit by Kerry, followed by a visit by Brennan, the head of the CIA, which I found mind-boggling. Usually these guys would go quietly, even secretly, especially given the CIA's global reputation.
It wasn't well publicized.
It wasn't, but it, you know, at least they acknowledged that it happened. It was out there. He did it. And then Biden. Maybe Biden came to work out a deal for his son. That would not be beyond their capabilities.
Well, what is our gas doing anyways?
Pardon me?
What is our gas doing in a country?
That's right.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, I've heard a lot of great discussion, I think, and I've got a much better understanding of the issues now than I did before this. But, you know, we're talking here and we have a big issue that's in front of us. And we need to think of how we're going to tackle it to make sure that we don't have another war in our hands. Whether it's a proxy war or whether it's the actual superpowers going at it. And, you know, in Massachusetts, there are some politicians that have a lot of influence on international issues. Kerry was a senator from our state. Markey is very active on the international committees. And I think, you know, somebody once told me that if you get three phone calls in a day, that's the opinions are starting to shift. If there's 10 phone calls in a day, that's a landslide public opinion in your district. And so essentially, you know, even with the people in this room, Markey and Elizabeth Warren could be terrified of the fact that peace is the big issue. And if peace is the big issue, they're going to make sure that it doesn't get to the fact that they have to have a war vote or any vote in the Senate. And so I'd say, you know, maybe we can't have a big protest saying that one thing or the other is a better solution, but if we can lobby ourselves because we're not necessarily in ties with big money and we're just people and we can make clear that this is a landslide opinion. 10 people call up their office in one day and say, you know, we want peace in Ukraine, don't do anything that's going to cause war. I think that that can already have some big impact, some big change.
Yeah. I think this is a long-term struggle, it's a generational project. And for them to not only try to take Ukraine, but actually to take Russia, that's what I see. And I was thinking about this. I have to attend a forum at MIT in March. It was chaired by Barry Kozin on the subject of Ukraine. And they had a fellow from the State Department there by the name of Eugene Fischel, division chief in the Office of Russian and Eurasian Analysis. And he made it pretty clear that they have in mind to destabilize the Russian regime. They were hoping that Russia will, that Putin will overextend himself and that protests will rise in Russia and so on and so on. So anyway, I do think this threat of war is very real. As the West, the capitalist system, whatever you want to call it, tries to, you know, keep on pushing wherever it finds an opening. But to Duncan's comment and David's comment about the task of the peace movement, you know, I think what happened with Syria is that the war had been going on for 2 years. The peace movement did not have a strong voice. Really, there was a debate within the ruling circles about what to do with Syria, and the right was pushing Obama to act, and finally that fluorine attack, and Obama said, oh, okay, I guess I'll have to attack. And so then it dragged it out, and there was visible debate. So that's what creates the conditions in the media for the broad amount of the public to understand that there's a problem, there's a decision. But here in Ukraine, there's no visible
debate in the media on what U.S. policy should be or what the options are. So we unfortunately have to painstakingly create that understanding and create that alternative understanding. And this issue, underlying issue, is this push of the West to continually control, in this case, Ukraine and eventually Russia, and by both economic and military means. Actually, ruling circles don't want war either, because they're really trying to do it economically, but war, you know, the military is part of the process also. So that's what we have to push against, but it's going to be hard.
Even without this debate, there's still, the polls are still very strongly opposed to any U.S. intervention in any wars. I mean, that has been consistent, regardless of what the propaganda machine is telling people. So, you know, they you don't even have to have a debate. That we know that, you know, if we take action, then we can start getting somewhere, I think. Also, maybe we need to be focusing more of our attention on NATO as a broader picture. John.
So, just a quick thing. One of the differences between now and situation with Syria was there was an active threat of the United States launching an attack, and that's when people are much more instamobilized. We don't have that right now. You know, things are happening at a much more covert level. And there's some hope, you know, of some form of a negotiated resolution to it. So I would say time probably isn't right for mass action. But you know, preparing and I think that also then speaks to the need. You can have one crisis after another like this in different circumstances, right? We could find ourselves in one of the Senkaku Daiyu Islands, which is much more likely trigger for great power in the nuclear war. So I think one of the things that speaks to us or the doing is the long, hard work of dealing with the system itself. One of the points is that hasn't really been illuminated here is how the United States has been using this crisis to continue the expansion of NATO. The movement of more forces into the Baltics, the movement of more forces into Poland. Poland is asking for two full combat battalions. And so, at another level, in terms of the scenario being played out, the U.S. is trying to seek additional military strategic advantage under the cover of the crisis.
But Czechoslovakia, or the Czech Republic, has refused. Mm-hmm. So this is what you were talking about, the contradictions within NATO. And I think what the U.S. is doing is not making concrete war preparations, but talking about more sanctions. And German industry is saying, no, you know, that's not feasible. So I can see some major confrontations, whether they're public or private, but occurring between Germany and some other NATO countries and the U.S. in terms of how to deal with it.
Do you see any smart ways that we can work without actually getting on the street and saying, don't do this, or look it up, we're going to be in the next Cold War? Wouldn't it be good to actually use the points that you've been raising today, and particularly to watch the play between parts of NATO and try to get press around that, try to get more education around whatever fractures we see that could be used to our advantage?
I think so, and to put pressure on the U.S. press to cover these major stories. This incineration of 40 people in Odessa. Mm-hmm. I actually saw an AFP piece that attributed the deaths to the victims. It said, you know, these pro-Russians were bothering these others, and so they got what they deserved. But, you know, those sorts of things need to be challenged. If the Boston Globe can just be barraged with protests saying, how come you're not talking, about these very crucial...
I think that might be more effective than our Congress, our members of Congress, who I think three or four, even 10 or 20 calls would change their mind. I have other experience.
Well, in that regard... A few weeks ago, I attended a fundraiser in honor of the late Jerry Grossman. And the speaker at the fundraiser was in a private home, was Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island. And he's a genuine liberal, quote unquote, a good voting record, generally speaking. But he opened up by doing his own little mini survey of world events, and he got to Ukraine, and he actually celebrated the involvement of NATO. He acknowledged, as Joe just did, the buildup of NATO forces in Poland and in the Baltic states, and said that this is a way that the United States is going to leverage this situation and bring it to a, quote, peaceful conclusion. So, you know, that's what you're up against with even some of your liberal politicians. But I think at the moment, you know, given the fact that obviously, and Obama addressed this today also, he acknowledged the fact that the public in this country has absolutely no taste, no yearning for any more wars. And his argument was, we're not going to war, we're just doing sanctions, we're doing everything we can, you know, to prevent the further conflagration. I think the immediate, addressing Duncan's points, I think the immediate question that urgently needs attention is the bloodletting that's going on right now, the decision on the part of Poroshenko and the forces around him, which are actually, have to be in concert with U.S. interests. They don't do anything without, you know, the State Department, the CIA, and U.S. government prodding and support. But the fact that so much killing is going on at this very moment is opening the door to a civil war. A civil war could open the door to a broader war. That's the great danger. They are, as I tried to indicate in the talk, I think they're operating under the assumption that the Russians have an overwhelming interest in staying out. But there are no guarantees. And the Russians have said, listen, you keep killing Russians or killing people who identify with us, and we'll be forced to act. And that is serious. And we have to get across the fact that the killing must stop immediately. I think that's the very first thing. That a forward movement of Ukrainian military forces, heavily armed at this juncture, suddenly heavily armed, has to stop. Negotiations have to replace force. I think that has to be the fundamental position. And as far as the U.S. public is concerned, I think it's very important wherever we have any kind of a soapbox, any kind of a platform, we have to make the point that it's in our interest. We have a direct and measurable interest to prevent the expansion of the conflict in Ukraine, which inevitably will envelop the United States. I saw a report 2 days ago, I don't know if it's verified, that there are 400 Blackwater mercenaries that are also operating in Ukraine. And if that's true, you might begin to see U.S. casualties, and that further complicate the situation. So I think the first step is stop the killing. The second step is to get the negotiation process rolling. And I think that's critical. And I think that could get a good deal of public support.
I think we're going to need to wrap up. You can hear from someone who hasn't spoken here.
So one of the things you were talking about is we're at war, and we don't know where this is going to lead, and the you know, the deal with China was one result of this, and it's just a mess that's going to lead to other messy things happening. And when I don't have a solid handle on it, but what are the domestic implications for this within the country? I see that for the most part, the media and the Democrats and Republicans are in lockstep, and this is a major distraction. I think a lot of people are confused about it. Kerry was talking about everybody increasing the military budget and all that kind of stuff. Any thoughts in terms of how this is going to play out domestically in terms of the increased austerity, the lack of resistance to that austerity, the attack on civil liberties?
I don't think that we're at war. I mean, not certainly in Ukraine. I mean, the U.S. remains at war in Afghanistan, and the crackdown on civil liberties continues and so on. But if the topic here is Ukraine, I don't think that it's likely that the U.S. is going to go to war. I think that's pretty much rule that out for the time being.
There are different ways that wars are fought. You know, it's like this, you know, has the danger of being a very hot war between the United States and the Soviet Union. And I, right now,
Russia.
I don't see, right, that's right, Russia, and I don't see that exploding right now. But it's, I use the word war in a general kind of way in terms of U.S. imperialism is acting out along with other kinds of imperialism.
Well, how about this possibility that for a long time Russia has been weak, and the consistent policy of the U.S. from the 90s anyway, maybe there was a period of uncertainty as the Soviet Union collapsed, but by 1994 NATO was definitely going to stay and it was going to expand, and it did and it did until it came to Georgia, and then it hit a roadblock, and now it's trying Ukraine, but it's hit another roadblock. It's quite possible that the majority of people in Congress will decide, well, why not stop there, you know, and let NATO or let Ukraine be another Finland, if that's the price of peace and stability. You know, and meanwhile, I understand that that France and Poland are saying, we don't need Ukraine in NATO. And I think there are probably some countries saying, do we really need NATO at all if we're being asked to spend 2% of our budget and we're only spending 1.1%, and Kerry's pressuring us to, you know, to raise that? After all, we're not under any threat from anybody.
One more question, and then we're going to wrap up. Go ahead.
I have a couple of concerns about the debate here. One is about the elections that Poroshenko election. What does he mean for the conflict in Ukraine? The other one is about also elections for the European Parliament, where by the indignados spoke. And the other thing that concerns me is about what do you know of about the Eurasian Alliance.
Eurasian Alliance?
That's the Eurasian Alliance, which I think the it means so many things. There is an ideology of Eurasianism that is pretty eclectic, that involves fascism and some leftover Sovietism and other questions as to what extent that ideology influences Putin, but I think when Putin talks about Eurasia, he's talking about Russia itself, which is not a solely European country, but is also Asian and has this complicated identity. He's sort of saying, why can't the whole of the Eurasian continent be united from Lisbon to Vladivostok, a common market? But so it has this very, you know, positive kind of sense to it, and there's also a darker sense to it, but I think it's quite vague. As to the significance of the election, I understand that Poroshenko's people talked with representatives of Russia in Europe, and Putin indicated that this was someone that he could work with, who is an oligarch, a familiar sort of person to him, with a lot of interest in Russia, a lot of dealings. He's indicated he's willing to accept a federal model, but he's also referred to the what RT calls self-defense forces, what others call the insurgents or the rebels, but he's referred to them as Somali pirates in a very disparaging sort of way. So it's not clear what he's going to do, but I think it's possible, given that Putin has said he will recognize this regime as representative of whoever voted, that they'll cut a deal. for continuation of cheap gas, but also autonomy for the East. I wouldn't be surprised if this is resolved comfortably for everyone, as opposed to just becoming more and more tense.
Okay. Let's thank our speakers, and then we have an announcement.
I think Christina wants a response on the European Parliament.
Okay.
And I, one word to respond, help! No, seriously, this is a very, very dangerous situation. First of all, you have a bunch of right-wing parties that have cleverly, at least tactically, cleaned their skirts of the out-and-out Nazi elements, although they're very close to them, but they've done a number of other things. They've exploited the economic situation to scapegoat immigrants, and that, of course, is the fundamental thing that they've done. But they've also adopted crypto-populist positions, which are a bunch of lies. They don't, I'm sure they don't go for any of this. But they've attacked austerity measures. They've called for greater social spending as part of an effort, really, to build, expand the base of their organizations. And they were enormously successful. Part of that success is the fact that the standard liberal conservative alliance parties, like the conservative liberal alliance in Great Britain, the socialists in France, that they have all pretty much abandoned defense of working class interests. They have adopted, to one degree or another, austerity policies. The left, on the other hand, has been somewhat ineffective and inarticulate in defending the interests of the people and fighting back strongly against austerity, against privatization, against growing unemployment, etc. And that has opened the door, hopefully temporarily, you know, to some incredibly frightening and troubling results. The fact that this right-wing independence party in Great Britain scored the highest. Similar results in France with Martine Le Pen, Le Pen's daughter. You know, things of that nature are extremely frightening. And they do have a bearing, I think, on the situation in Ukraine, in the sense, really, that there's an ugly right-wing current there that could easily, you know, be incorporated into the agenda of some of these right-wing parties in Europe. Although I don't see evidence of that happening at this moment, but it opens the door to that. So I think the answer is, I saw a piece recently that emphatically said, it's very important for left-center, left forces, progressive forces in Europe to steadfastly, coherently, and determinately take a strong stand against the economic and social policies that are renting the social fabric in those countries. And secondly, exposing the right wing for their lies. And most important, of course, continuing to struggle against the racist attacks upon immigrants.
And exactly what we have to be doing here, too, not just in Europe. Okay, thank you. Information and it's been clarified a lot. Paul has an announcement.
So just before people leave, if you have not signed the referendum materials here that will put the minimum increase in the minimum wage and the right to 5 days a year of sick leave for people who work full time, if you have not signed that yet, we'll put it on the ballot. Unless we get enough signatures, it will not happen. We have about another 10 days get this done. So please, before you leave, if you haven't signed all of these petitions yet, please come back and do so.
Thank you. Green rainbow.